Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In 2004, according to figures from the U.S. Census Bureau, the poverty rate in the United States rose for the fourth year in a row. 37 million Americans live below the poverty line, and significant numbers, tens of millions, of them are children. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking with Dr. Nancy Cawthon. She is Deputy Director of the National Center for Children in Poverty, and we'll be talking about some of the characteristics of poor children in the United States, looking at some of the hardships they face, and talking about why it is that child poverty matters. Questions, of course, are welcome as we move through the hour. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, comments, you can call. The only thing that we ask of callers is that they're just brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many people as possible and keep things moving along. But certainly, anyone is welcome to call. The National Center for Children in Poverty is based at Columbia University. Our guest is a sociologist by her training. She's a nationally recognized authority on the history and dynamics of American social welfare policy since the New Deal, and has written extensively on child poverty in the United States. She is joining us this morning by telephone. Dr. Cawthon, hello.
Morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today. We certainly appreciate it. Perhaps we can start out with some numbers. I sort of hesitate to start always with numbers, but I think that that would make sense. Can you talk a little bit about poverty in the United States? And maybe, in fact, before we talk about numbers of people.
I have to tell you, I have loud music in my ear. I cannot hear you.
Oh, hold on a second. I think we're okay. How about now?
Still loud music.
All right. Well, obviously, we got some wires crossed here. How about
now? There we go. That's great. Oh,
my apologies. Sometimes, you know,
things happen.
Things happen. Anyway, okay. So, thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be with you. We appreciate it.
And I think here, because, you know, how it is that government is, it is consumed with statistics and numbers, and definitions are important. So probably we should talk about the very concept of poverty and how it is we define it, because we do define it with numbers. So how do we do that?
That's an excellent place to start. We have our government's official poverty measure, which, just to give you an idea of where that stands, that's about $16,000 to $17,000 annually for a family of three, and about $20,000 for a family of four. We know, however, and experts universally agree, that this measure that we've used since the 1960s is outdated. It was originally based on studies that showed that families spent about a third of their incomes on food. So what was done was, what does the average family spend on food? Multiply that by three, and we have our poverty level. And then since then, it's been increased for inflation. The problem with that measure is that it no longer makes sense to use the cost of food as that basis, because food is now so much smaller a portion of families' incomes than it was in the 1960s. Things like housing, childcare, medical care, all of those things cost a lot more. So we know that no family of four, you know, two parents, two children, can live comfortably and adequately in the U.S. in 2006 on $20,000. So there's a lot of research that's been done out there to look at how much does it actually take a family to live. And we're talking basic necessities here. So no money for fun stuff, just housing, transportation, childcare, medical care, food, etc. On average, we know that it takes about an income of about twice the poverty level to get to that that spot. So again, that's $40,000 for a family of four. Mm. Now, of course, it depends on, do you live in New York? Do you live in Chicago? Do you live in a small rural area? And so we know those numbers vary tremendously depending on where folks live. So across the U.S. for a family of four, it takes anywhere from about $30,000 to $60,000 to make ends meet. And in fact, for Chicago, the number turns out to be exactly twice the poverty level, about $30,000.
So if they – okay, so – if we say so, let me ask you this question. So let us look, take what is the official federal poverty line for a family of four. Now, so the government is still saying that anybody, a family of four with annual income of less than $20,000, we're going to say that's where the line is.
Exactly.
So if we ask how many families, if we just go by the federal government, their standard, how many families or how many individuals are we talking about?
Well, we know when we talk about children that 18% of children live in poor families, and so that's nearly 14 million children.
Mm-hmm. And so is that the real number, or is that the number if we use the federal poverty line as our baseline?
That's the number using the federal poverty line.
So if we ask the question, well, we've now realized that the federal poverty line is not where it should be. And then if we really say, if, for example, in a city like Chicago, for a family of four to be able to make it, it doesn't cost $20,000 a year. It costs $40,000 a year. So that means we would have to increase pretty significantly. I don't know if that means we end up doubling the number, but that we'd have to now have a significant increase in the number of poor families and then the number of poor children.
Well, in fact, what it means is that we more than double the number of children. 40% of children in this country are living in low-income families.
Okay.
So that's 29 million children.
And just then also talk about trends, just as I mentioned, and I think that was a figure that I got from material that is on your website. And by the way, maybe I also should mention that for people who are interested in finding out about the center and getting basic information on this subject, you can go to their website, which is www.nccp.org. So that's for National Center for Children in Poverty. That number that came out of reflected the census data showing that for the last several years, at least, the poverty rate rose. It's fair to say that at least over the last 4 years, and things probably haven't changed since 2004, that we're saying that the poverty rate has been on the increase.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, it's been the last 5 years. So every year since 2000. And we're about to get the data for the most recent year will come out in about a month. So we'll be able to see if the trend has continued. But it has been a steady climb. So child poverty has increased by 12% over the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm. This, I guess, invites a very large question, one that I'm sure we could talk a long time about. But the question, why is it that here in the United States, this is one of the wealthiest countries in the world? We certainly have a lot of resources, and we have a lot of wealthy individuals living here, and a lot of people who, if not wealthy, are doing well. Why is it that poverty is at this level and in fact, continues to go up, or at least has for the last 5 years?
To understand just why we have poverty in the U.S. to begin with, we have to look at what causes poverty. And the biggest thing has to do with low-wage work. What most people don't realize, the media gives us this very, very narrow image of poor people in America. And what they tend to do is focus on the most troubled families that really do not typify poor families in America. So we know if you look at low-income families, those families living with incomes below twice the poverty line, over 80% of those children have a parent who is employed, and 55% of those children have at least one parent who's employed full-time. So the first problem is low wages. And when you look at what's happened over the last 5 years, and we're actually about to release a new report on this topic, you see that if you look in the Midwest, for example, the families that have been hardest hit by those increases, because actually there's been a 30% increase in child poverty in the Midwestern region over the last 5 years, so much, much higher, more than double what's happened nationally. The families that have lost ground are families that were employed. And so you've got decent-paying manufacturing jobs going away and being replaced with service jobs that don't pay good wages and also don't come with the kinds of benefits like health insurance, sick time, decent retirement plans that the jobs that are going away have. And so part of the reason why poverty has increased over the last 5 years, because the state of the economy hasn't been so good. In terms of why we have the highest poverty rate in the developed world when we're the richest nation on earth, that also has to do with our government policies. There are policies that can prevent poverty. There are policies that can help families in poverty. The United States does a very poor job of both trying to prevent poverty and for those families who are in poverty, we do very, very little for them.
One quick question let me ask, and then I have a caller here. I want to promise them we won't make them wait forever, but this has to do with the minimum wage. Earlier this summer in June, Congress was debating this. The federal minimum wage is now $5.15, and the members of Congress were talking about an increase from that to 7.25. Would that really, and that it seems that always debates over the minimum wage are very hard fought and, yes, and difficult, even if such a thing could be achieved. So we get that up from $5.15 to $7.25. Would that make very much difference for the kind of people that we're talking about?
Absolutely. 35% of minimum wage workers are the sole earners for their families. So that's an important thing to start out with. Now, one full-time job at even $7.25 an hour is not going to get a family even to the poverty line, let alone that low-income line. But especially for families who have two workers, one worker is making minimum wage, the other is making higher, you know, that might be enough to get that family to a point where they can be totally self-sufficient. And for those families that are relying solely on minimum wage, anything is going to make a difference.
I should introduce again our guest, and then I have some callers here I want to get to. We're talking this morning with Dr. Nancy Cawthon. She is the Deputy Director of the National Center for Children in Poverty, which is based at Columbia University at the Mailman School of Public Health. And it is the nation's leading public policy center dedicated to promoting the economic security, health, and well-being of America's low-income families and children. She is a sociologist by her training and has been affiliated with the center for some time. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we'll go first to someone in Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I had a question, and that is, on an individual basis, how much per year as taxpayers do we pay toward the coffers of public aid? I had read an article some years prior to 1995 in the Sun-Times that said that on an individual basis, one penny per year out of our taxes goes toward public aid. Is that true?
That's a very good question, and unfortunately, I don't know the precise answer. A lot of times, the amount of money that we spend on low-income families is exaggerated because everything is included from things like cash assistance programs, but Medicaid spending is included. Well, Medicaid spending is huge, but the bulk of Medicaid spending goes to pay for medical care for the disabled and long-term care for the elderly. So it's not low-income children who are accounting for the majority of those costs. So if you were to just add up the sort of safety net programs, it's a pretty really small portion of our federal budget and state budgets as well.
Yes, I thought so.
All right. Well, does that get at your question? Okay.
Well, it answers the question from the standpoint that I made the effort to follow up on that article by calling the different federal and state agencies to give me a straight answer as far as how much was actually spent per person, and they didn't have an answer for me.
Hmm.
And I think it's ludicrous that one penny out of my taxes goes toward public aid. It's just, it's unconscionable in this country.
Well, I appreciate your comments. I thank you for the call. Let's continue. We'll go to Savoy, someone here on a cell phone, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting program. A couple of quick questions, observations. I'll go ahead and ring off and take the answer off the air. I was wondering if your guest could comment on what looks like a systemic problem. In other words, the amount of children, percentage of children being born out of wedlock to single parents, because it's my understanding that if you do have a single parent, a child out of wedlock, that rate of poverty is quite a bit higher. And if there's a percentage of anywhere between 70% and 45% of children being born out of wedlock, it just seems like an absolutely monumental problem. Also, too, wonder if you could comment on the number of children who fail to go to college or drop out of high school, because then also, too, it would seem to me that they'd be saddled with low-paying jobs for their entire life. And I'll go ahead and ring off and listen. Thanks.
All right. Well, can you answer those questions?
Yes, I can. In terms of non-marital births, one thing that's important to remember is a lot of times people confuse teenage childbearing with non-marital childbearing. So we know, for example, that 70% of non-marital births are to women over 20. Okay, so most non-marital births are not to teenagers. In terms of poverty, part of the problem is it's teenagers having babies, whether or not they're married, although having a baby as a teenager, if you're not married, does not bode well for one's future. But people often say, oh, see, this is what's causing poverty. But those teenagers who are having babies are already poor, okay? Most middle-class teenagers don't have babies because they want to go to college. They stand a pretty good chance of going to college. They see opportunity in their future and know that for that opportunity to come about, they need to not have a child while they're a teenager. But if you're sort of living in dire straits, you've grown up in poverty, you've gone to lousy schools, you are living perhaps in a chaotic family situation. Again, this is the portrayal of poverty that we see in the media. That is not the reality for most poor people living in this country. So for the very small number of troubled families, that's where you're likely to see teenage childbearing. And yes, that's a problem, but we need to not confuse that with that's just not the story of poverty in this country. Now let's see, the second question was about education.
Yeah, and whether how much difference it would make if for those people either who drop out of high school or maybe they complete high school but they don't go on to college, if we could get those people to be more successful in their education careers and get higher levels of education, how much could we perhaps reduce poverty in the United States?
It's an excellent question. We know that high school dropouts don't stand a good chance of making a decent living. It used to be, after World War II, we were at a point where we had this, you know, growth of blue-collar manufacturing jobs unionized. And so if you had a high school degree, you could actually, and especially if you were male, you could command a middle-class income. Those are the jobs that we've lost, and it is very difficult for someone with, even if they get their high school degree, to do well economically at this point in time. The problem is college is becoming more and more out of reach for low-income young people. So the kind of federal aid that people can get has been diminished. State aid to their state universities has decreased. So there are lots and lots of obstacles for a child who's grown up in a low-income family to get to college. The other thing is that we know that a college degree at one point was pretty much a guarantee that you could make a decent living. That's no longer true. So we're seeing more and more people with either some amount of college or even a college degree ending up in the ranks of low-income families. And one final point I would like to make about education is Americans are great believers in education as the route to success in this country. But we're at a point right now where our public education system is so troubled, and all the inequalities we have in income just get translated into our public education system because we fund it with property taxes. So rich neighborhoods have rich schools, and poor neighborhoods have poor schools. So right now, what our education system is doing is reinforcing the inequalities that already exist. Our public education system has not been an equalizing force, at least not in recent decades.
We are just about at a midpoint here. I have some other calls we'll get right to, but for anyone who has just tuned in, I'd like again to introduce the guest. We're speaking with Dr. Nancy Cawthon. She is the Deputy Director of the National Center for Children in Poverty. It's based at Columbia University. She is a sociologist by her academic training. She's a nationally recognized authority on the history and dynamics of American social welfare policy since the New Deal, and particularly is interested in the effects of state and federal policies on the ability of low-wage workers to achieve family economic security. And we're talking about poverty generally, but specifically the idea here was to try to talk about children in poverty. And we have several callers and would welcome others into the conversation. Again, the only thing we ask is that people just try to be brief and ask that so we can get in as many callers as possible and keep things moving along. But anyone is welcome in to the conversation. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And next, we'll talk with someone in Chicago on our line two right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Doctor, let me just say, so you'll know where I'm coming from, I'm visually impaired, and I think the best thing that President Bush could have done was sign the Americans for Disabilities Act, because before that, I can tell you that we were discriminated against because of our handicap. I went into a place, and the guy said, if I hire you, my boss will fire me, and he gave me $5 for coming in. So we have a lot of that, but I won't get into that. I know that's not what you're talking about today. But I'm thinking, how do you feel about tying the minimum wage to the cost of living adjustment every year? What do you think of that?
First of all, let me say I'm not an economist, and so that's really getting out of my expertise. I do think we need to find ways to make sure that the minimum wage keeps going up. I mean, part of the problem we're having right now is that the minimum wage has not been increased for 9 years.
That's right.
And so anyone depending on that minimum wage has lost ground. I mean, most of the rest of us are getting raises.
Well, you know, I don't mean to interrupt you, but you know, the only progress seems to be made when someone is part of a union. If you're in a non-union shop, and I've seen this, no pun intended, but I've seen this, there are employers that will pay you as little as they can if they know they can get away with it and if they know you need the job.
Well, that's a very important point, because people tend to argue that, well, we have so much low-wage work in this country, and, you know, it's just the shift, and so there's really nothing we can do. They forget that the jobs that became those good, well-paying manufacturing jobs, those were also not so great jobs either. It was unionization and unions fighting for benefits that made those jobs good jobs. So,
yes, we have a bill in front of the city council here in Chicago today that would make it mandatory for stores like Target to start their minimum wage workers out at $10 an hour. And our mayor is fighting it tooth and nail, claiming that it would put the people on the south side and the west side, and let's just cut right to the cord. He's talking about African Americans that wouldn't be able to find jobs, and I just don't believe that.
There are a number of different ways to approach that issue. We're at a time and place where there is very little expectation from the public for corporations to take responsibility for their workers and also to take responsibility for the communities where they live.
Well,
so we have oil companies, refineries, making huge profits, but yet trying to get local incentives, threatening to leave otherwise. Well,
the tragedy is you pay it by raising the minimum wage, or you pay it by building more prisons. So decide.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is there are lots of ways to get higher wages. Minimum wage is one of them. We have now made it practically impossible for workers to organize in this country. We know that Walmart has done everything they can to prevent unionization. So the minimum wage is not the only route to increasing wages. Plus, we also know if you pay your workers more, if you take care of your workers, they're more loyal employees. You have lower turnover, and you don't constantly have to hire and train new workers. That can actually be more efficient.
You get what you pay for.
So, yes.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's continue. We'll go next back here to someone local in Urbana. This is 9-1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I had a couple of things I was hoping your guest could comment on. When this whole minimum wage increase was being discussed a few weeks ago, I heard an economist talking on Face the Nation, or one of those Sunday morning programs, about, she was basically saying raising the minimum wage wouldn't really help get people out of poverty, so more in the way of training people. And I guess that seems counterintuitive to me, because you can train and train and train people, but we're still going to need people doing the jobs, working at McDonald's or other low-paying jobs, and we're still going to need those people, and I feel that they deserve a decent wage. The other thing was, I recently read Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickeled and Dimed, and she talked about how, because people will say, we don't need to raise the minimum wage, the market will take care of it, because if there's less, if there's less unemployment, I forget what it was, but anyway, people will only work for a wage that is sufficient for them, and they'll fight for a higher wage if there's low unemployment. But she was saying it doesn't work that way, because even in really low unemployment areas, people the time to try to find another job or to negotiate a wage, or there's a lot of secrecy involving what wages are. So I was hoping you could address those two topics, and I'll hang up and listen off the air.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Well, as our host said at the beginning of the program, in terms of minimum wage, the debates out there are so heated, and the rhetoric really gets out of control. I mean, why does it have to be either train workers or pay them minimum wage? I mean, a lower wage. You can raise their wages and you can train them. There again, that's a strategy for investing in your workers, and then they're more likely to invest themselves in your company. Let's see. You said you had. She said you had two questions.
Well, I'm not sure that I really got the full drift of the caller's point. I guess she was talking about the fact that where is it we spend the money? If some say, well, we really need to spend money to develop the workers, but if you don't have jobs that pay a living wage for them, that there's sort of no point in putting the training into developing the workers if the jobs don't pay a wage that people can live on.
Well, and also, she was making the comment, people who are against a minimum wage increase will often talk about what the market will take care of and what the market won't take care of. And, the market is not some force of nature out there. I mean, we regulate the market in various ways. And we've had a minimum wage for a long time. The evidence seems to be pretty clear that, there are always these dire threats made that, all these jobs will go away. And so instead of making a lower wage, then all these people will be unemployed. And study after study after study has shown, because now we have a national laboratory with so many states that have raised their minimum wages since the federal hasn't been raised, they show time and time again that those economies are healthy, and the dire unemployment predictions just haven't materialized. Mm-hmm. That's not what happened.
Well, just for here, we've gotten into this subject area, and I think maybe it was because I raised the issue of the minimum wage, and fair enough, because when I asked the question about why it is the poverty rate in the country is so high and why it is that we have the highest poverty rate in the developed world, you said, well, one reason is the prevalence of low-wage work. But also, you have to ask the question, in what sort of role has government policy played here now, at least going back to the 1980s, that we have been debating this issue of what government can and should do to try to assist families that are having a hard time making it. Specifically, what do you think, if you look at what we have done, particularly all of that, everything that comes under that broad heading of welfare reform, has that helped? Has that made things more difficult? Have we gone in the wrong direction?
In terms of policy, one of the best things that we did was to create the earned income tax credit. Because what that does is you have to be working to even qualify for it. And so that gets away from public concern about, we're giving you a government handout. So you have to be working to get the earned income tax credit. And it really helps add a substantial amount to the total income of low-wage workers. And part of its intent was to reverse the effects of our regressive Social Security taxes that hit low-income workers disproportionately. So that's been one really good thing that we've done. Also, actually, prior to welfare reform, Congress seemed to realize that, all right, if we're going to expect people to work, then we need to help them out. We need to help them out with child care. We need to help them out with insurance. So child care assistance and access to public health insurance were both increased substantially, and that has really helped. The problem is, because of the public perception of what poverty is in this country, when people think of poverty, they don't think of low-wage workers. They think of people who aren't working, and there just really aren't that many of those people around, especially you look at the welfare rolls. They've been cut in half in the last decade. I do have to say that those truly, truly troubled families, and now the people who are left on the welfare rolls are primarily those truly, truly troubled families where a parent doesn't have adequate education to hold a decent job. Maybe there's abuse going on in the household, all kinds of, you know, things. Being homeless, for instance. We do have a small group of families in this country that need some intensive help before they can get into the labor force. But in terms of policy, our greatest need is for policies that support low-wage work. Our policymakers said to people on welfare, we want you to get a job, we want you to become self-sufficient. Well, a low-wage job in and of itself isn't going to get you to that point of economic self-sufficiency.
We have about 15 minutes, maybe a little bit less, in this part of Focus 580. And again, I'd like to introduce our guest, Dr. Nancy Cawthon. She is the Deputy Director of the National Center for Children in Poverty, which is based at Columbia University, where they do a lot of research on the very issues that we're talking about. She's a sociologist and has done a lot of research on poverty policy in the United States. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And by the way, if you're interested in finding out more about this issue or about the center, they do have a website that I mentioned. It's an easy address. It's www.nccp for National Center for Children in Poverty, and that's a .org. We have some other callers here, and next, I believe, we'll talk with someone on our line three, and that is Urbana. Hello.
Hello
there. Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. I guess I just wanted to mention that the main issue for me is that the culture of blame that's put on those who are poor in our country is not being referenced to, except for in the callers maybe who are doing that. And there was one in particular that said she didn't want any of her money to go towards helping anyone. It sounded to me, that's the way I took it anyways. And I think this is a probably the biggest issue. We're looking at government programs a lot in your discussion, and I think that we have to look at us as a society and how much we are willing to help those in need. And if that isn't one of the major causes, I'd like you to discuss that a little bit.
Sure. And in fairness to that caller, I heard the caller to say that actually she thought it was bad that so little of her tax money was going into.
I thought she said something else, and I may have misunderstood her, but my point, I thought about not making it so personal, because that is still an issue, whether or not she said that or not, and it also kind of came into another caller, maybe, if I understood him correctly, and he was looking at the poor as a possible problem because of their education and so on and so forth, but the issue that I'm trying to bring up is that they... us as a society should just be willing to help those in need, and that's kind of a moral issue. Why are we so low on this worldwide scale of helping those that are poor? That's my real question, I guess.
Well, and that's an excellent point. Let's give the guest, Dr. Cawthon, a chance to make some response.
I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Yes.
One of the problems is that in this country we see almost everything in individual terms. So I often get questions about poverty that the underlying assumption is that if people who are poor just made different choices and did things differently, they wouldn't be poor. What we fail to realize as a nation is the economic, you know, what's going on in the economy, what's going on in policy, what's going on, what we're talking about, and especially that's why I think it's so important to talk about low-wage work. Our economy has been transformed, and unionization is going away, and that is a big part of our problem. Media is a huge part of this problem, because reporters want to focus on, I can't tell you how many times I've been told, well, I want a compelling story. Well, the compelling story seems to be like the person who has the most troubled life in the world and is fighting against all odds. And guess what? Surprise, surprise. They failed. They don't make it. But it's all about an individual story. Or the other favorite story is the person who starts out in that same place and succeeds against all odds. Those are not typical stories. Those do not help people understand poverty in this country. But it's what drives media coverage, and it's what drives the policy discussion. So getting a way to figure out how we get people to understand that it's tricky. I mean, this is just part of our sort of, you know, national, how we are about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, if you compare the United States to, say, most European countries, we have an incredibly different view about children and responsibility for raising children. In other countries, children are seen as a social responsibility. They are seen as a government responsibility, because today's children are going to grow up to be tomorrow's citizens, tomorrow's workers, tomorrow's parents. So therefore, if you want to invest in the well-being of your society, you invest in the well-being of your children. That's not how we view it here. We see children as the sole responsibility of their parents. And so if they're not doing well, well, we blame the parents. Again, until we understand that we are doing ourselves, I mean, moral issues, humanitarian concerns, all of those things are there, but we are also just doing a great disservice to the future of our nation to ignore the problems of poor children.
Well, you know, given the fact that this kind of personal responsibility thing is so ingrained in us, and it reaches into so many areas. Just for example, to name another thing, it reaches in the area of public health. And I know the people who work in that area are very concerned that, in fact, it's undercut the very notion of public health, because we have this idea that so many people have this idea that if you get sick, it's somehow your fault. We want to say, well, what did you do? And we can't seem to get away from that, given that it seems that any kind of policy solutions we do somehow are going to have to work in this angle of helping people help themselves. And isn't that may be a nuisance, but doesn't that personal responsibility thing, isn't that going to have to be woven into our policy approaches to basically to get broad support for whatever we do?
I think it has been. I mean, that was one of the things that welfare reform did. It said, okay, to get help, you have to do X, Y, and Z. The problem is, we made those policies too punitive. So again, I mean, the Bush administration has just increased the work requirements for people who are on cash assistance. The states are really grappling with that and wondering how they're going to make this happen, given that many of the people who are collecting cash assistance right now, they are not employable at the moment. A lot of them could be, but they need drug treatment. They need to get out of abusive relationships. Some of them are caring for sick family members. So we should require personal responsibility, but we also... we've sort of gone too far the other extreme. Okay, there's your individual responsibility to yourself, to your society, to your community, to your government, but what about government's responsibility to you as a citizen and your well-being? We really seem to have lost that. You know, you mentioned the public health view.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that gets talked about a lot these days is the increase in obesity, and especially among the poor. So how is it, you know, that you could be poor yet be overweight? Like somehow this doesn't, you know, make any sense to people. Well, I work in Harlem. And I can tell you, within a three-block range, I can find three McDonald's, a Burger King, Kentucky Fried Chicken. I can find the most fattening food, most unhealthy food, and good luck trying to get something to eat around here that's fast, nutritious, and affordable.
We have some other callers here. We'll try to get in a couple in the time that remains, and we'll go next to someone in Champaign in line number one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. And I didn't hear the first part of the program, so forgive me if you brought this up. But I've never heard anybody besides myself advocate this, but I think one way to get the minimum wage raised on a regular basis, if there was any way of possibly implementing it, would be to tie the minimum wage to a multiple of congressional wages so that, you know, they would have a direct interest in those people at the bottom of the wage ladder. Every time they wanted to raise, you know, they would have to give everybody else at the bottom a raise.
Well, you know, certainly we hear policymakers talking about that, and a lot of people have made the point about, you know, Congress raising, you know, their incomes by $30,000 in the 9 years that the minimum wage hasn't gone up. I mean, realistically, from a political standpoint, you're never going to see anything like that happen. I mean, it makes nice rhetoric, but you know, the business lobby would just never allow it because of the forces that increase congressional wages are out of their control as well. So, but I do think it helps rhetorically to make that point.
Well, maybe if we could get some grassroots candidates coming along and challenging I won't use a pejorative term, but these people who are theoretically representing us now and using this as a campaign issue, maybe it would move them some. Who knows? But thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to line number two. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hey, I had a thought for your eating problem in Harlem. If you eat at home, it's much cheaper and there's far less trans fat. As a sociologist, I was wondering if you had ever studied the correlation between illegitimacy and poverty. With the help of the federal government, the African-American community, before welfare, went from having 75% of their kids born within wedlock to the current point where only 25% are born within wedlock. You know, you may have the government may have an overarching responsibility to you, but the two people who are most likely to make sure that you're successful in life are two involved parents.
You've raised a number of issues here. First, I have to address your eating at home thing, okay? We're talking about a situation where most adults have to work. And in low-income families, you have people who are working two or three jobs, and especially if you've got a single mom, you know, I got to tell you, I don't cook. That single mom doesn't have a lot of time to be going to the grocery store. And again, good luck in this neighborhood finding a grocery store of any decent size with affordable food, okay? But you're talking about the time it takes to shop. It's not always that cheap to make. We know study after study shows that poor people pay more in their neighborhoods for the same stuff that the rest of us pay less for. So, you know, that's part of that issue. But parents are working so many more hours than they used to. That's why we have so much fast food. So I won't go on with that. I don't know where you're getting your statistic about 75% of African-American babies being born in a marital relationship before welfare reform and now 25%. That's just those are just incorrect. We know that teen pregnancy, because again, I think it's a mistake to a lot of times when people are talking about non-marital births, if you want to talk about the issue associated with poverty, it's not non-marital births, it's teenage births, okay? And the teenage birth rate has gone down by, I think it's like a third since the early 90s. And the group that it's declined the most among is among African Americans. In fact, teenagers younger than 18, the teen birth rate among African Americans decreased by 55% over about the last 13 years. So that problem is actually getting a lot better, but people don't seem to realize that.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry, I'm going to have a call, a couple of calls we can't take. Is there, obviously this is a very complicated subject and we've just touched on a few things. Is there something you could say in the way of wrapping up?
One thing, we really haven't talked much about Illinois. And one thing I think is important to note is that Illinois has done a number of really wonderful things policy-wise. So this new program, All Kids, making health insurance available, public health insurance available to children in families of all incomes. I mean, things like that are important. Unlike most other states, Illinois tries to serve every family who's eligible for child care assistance and who applies for it. There are plenty of people out there who need it who don't get it. But there are policies, there are things that we can do. This is not like some intractable problem. But until we get back to the earlier caller's point about understanding that poverty is not simply within the control of an individual to make a choice, change behavior, and then everything will be fine. And as long as we have that belief, we're not going to get very far.
Our guest, Nancy Collins, Deputy Director of the National Center for Children in Poverty, based at Columbia University in New York City. Dr. Collins, thank you very much.
Been a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.